I'd like to thank the organizers for letting me be here. This is a lot of fun to come back. Well, not for me to come back to Cambridge, this is the wrong place, but there was a number of anniversary meetings last year to do with 100 years of superconductivity. So it's nice to be able to meet with the person who actually did the work. So let me tell you what we did over a period of actually about a couple of months, Phil Anderson and I, to observe what Brian had predicted. And most of my slides are actually copies of my notebook entries in my Bell Labs notebooks, which, although we all left Bell Labs and had to leave our notebooks behind by law, by fiat, are still available in a building in New Jersey, and you can go there and photograph them and so on. So the time period, as you've heard, I'm going to talk mostly about 1963, but it really goes back in my, I believe, to Geiger, as has already been mentioned, who showed the gap appeared in a tunnel junction and actually was the first person to invent a thin film tunnel junction with the thin insulator between. I joined the Bell Labs in April of 61. Brian's paper was submitted June 62. The first entry in my notebook about his letter, which means that Phil Anderson was back from Cambridge, was in August. In January, it was 63, we first tried an aluminum lead junction, which is interesting for reasons I'll tell you. We saw the first supercurrent in tin lead junctions. In May, we saw we saw some field dependence there, as I'll describe, but in May, I measured this critical current field pattern in a lead-lead junction, which is in all the textbooks. In June, Sid Shapiro reported the AC effect, and in January 64, as you'll hear later from Arnold Silver, the Ford group reported the double junction interference. In February of 64, up to that point, the Jolison effect was strictly confined to thinking about thin film junctions. But because of some work by Parks and Michelle, Anderson generalized the Jolison effect, or I believe he did, to all these weak link structures and bridges and so on. Now, when I got to Bell Labs, I joined a group that was doing work on semiconductors, and we decided, because it already had some equipment that had been used for taking derivatives of semiconductor tunnel diodes, we decided to try and look in superconductor tunnel diodes for similar effects. Now, you would think that I would just copy what Geiger had done, but I didn't. First, superconducting energy gaps that I saw were actually in a heavily doped silicon lead junction where the lead was simply pressed onto the silicon surface. That's what this is. This is from an XY recorder sheet, which I stuck into my lab notebook. And for those of you who are too young to know what XY recorders is, you have to ask somebody old sitting next to you. Now, just as an aside, I did not spend all my time on Jolicon Brian's effect. I actually spent probably 80-90% of my time on these experiments, which was to take the derivatives of Geiger type junctions, either SIN or SIS. And as you go to energies above the gap, the gap is down here. As you go to energies above the gap, in the second derivative, you see all these features. And with Bill McMillan, we realized that the gap equation could be unfolded to give the coupling energy what today would be called the pairing mechanism. So if somebody did this experiment with high TC, then the problem would be solved, but it hasn't been done yet. Well, the experiment's been done, but not a really satisfactory unfolding procedure. This really took most of my time. So now we go to Brian's predictions. He really made, in our minds, two predictions, two effects. We discussed, thought of them as two separate effects, the DC current at zero voltage and the AC supercurrent which frequency is changing with voltage. Now, my first entry in a notebook, which implied that Phil was back from Cambridge, is this one. You're supposed to look at that dot, which is supposed to be red. Need to produce superconductor tunneling in an H equals zero space, H less than a tenth of a Gauss, actually. Now, where that number came from must have been Phil, but I certainly didn't think about it. And then the rest of this is about testing a new metal can. So this was in August, so just a month or so after Brian's paper was submitted, I think it was, and Phil came back. This page here, look at the bottom, and it says aluminum oxide lead unit to be run in Tejabol's cryostat. Now, Ted had the only cryostat at Bell Labs which went to 3/10 degree, helium-3 cryostat. So it's the only way that we could really get the aluminum to be kind of decently superconducting. We made a unit, set of junctions, which weren't particularly low resistance either, as has been discussed earlier. And we measured it in Ted's cryostat, which was a very noisy lab. So we didn't, as Brian has just discussed, we didn't see any supercurrent. Now Phil, I remember this, was very puzzled. He said, you know, you should be seeing, he believed it. He said, you should be seeing the supercurrent. The next day he came back and said, you know, there's this coupling energy. And that was, as he mentioned in his talk, the idea that there was a coupling energy between the two phases. So you had to overcome noise that was going down the leads just from room temperature, or much worse, probably from the lab environment itself. So that was early in January. So this is the page where I believe we first saw the Jordison effect. And it's been split into two parts, so we can read it. The top half, we hadn't had much success making tin lead junctions, so we decided to heat the substrate a little bit in oxygen. So there's a the system we just built, put together as a drying column and liquid nitrogen to dry oxygen, and a little hot plate with the substrate sitting on it, and a thermocouple. And when we measured the first of those, this is as big as a supercurrent as we got, this little current here, and then this is the IV characteristic with the tin gap showing and the light, you know, the sum gap and the difference gap. But what's interesting here is to read what we wrote. We looked at unit, I mean, 1.7, that was the code. All good, which means they were all showing this gap characteristic and had a similar resistance. All show peculiar low resistance at the origin. A bar magnet or horseshoe magnet, I have both in the lab, brought up outside the dewar destroys the effect. Tried to burn out by going up to 300 millivolts, but characteristic not altered. See, we like others, or were conscious that this effect might be due to a little short, or we believed if we put enough voltage or current through this junction, we'd burn out the short. But it didn't happen, and 300 millivolts was actually pretty violent for a little junction like this. So the next day was similar low resistance, similar Jordison effect, or leak. Phil Anderson's arguments seemed to preclude leaks. And the strange thing is, in the first publication, we didn't really discuss the fact that these junctions were definitely field sensitive. I think we just said they responded to field or something like that. So this is what was published. Brian showed this already, tin lead junction with a current that by then was skipping all the way across to the gap characteristic. I guess this was measured at the 1 degree, which we could reach. And now let me describe what really happened in the lab and what Phil Anderson did. This was the equipment as it was pretty much at the time. And the sample was, of course, down there in the dewar. All this was stuff that I could get from the Bell Labs stockroom. So these gold-plated plugs up here are actually the things you see in central telephone offices, because they didn't have coax and coax. I mean, it was only Bell Systems. So And these cables were the same kind of cables that the ladies are using in central offices. And they were wonderful because they're all gold-plated and they never fail. So we're measuring the ID characteristic here. As soon as I saw that kind of characteristic, which I've shown you, I called Phil. He came up to the lab. He took this little bar magnet and he retreated from the end of the room where the viewer was towards the door, swinging the magnet, and the pen was jumping between the zero voltage state and the finite voltage state as he did that. So there was no doubt, and he reached the door and it was still responding. There was no doubt that it was sensitive to small fields. Then when he left, this is the first measurement of the current dependence on the field. I took the magnet and decided that if I put it on the table, the lower level of the table here, and moved it towards the viewer, then I could increase the field. So the first plot of critical current versus field was made that way, as I mentioned today. Now I think what happened was that I plotted that on a little corner of my XY recorder sheet, which didn't survive, didn't get stuck in the notebook, unfortunately. But that was the first measurement. And I regret now that we didn't publish it. You know, it was critical current versus position of the magnet on the bench. But of course, when you're a young person, you don't do things like that. I probably would do it now. But anyway, that's what the junctions look like a little later. Crossing of the two films in narrow regions with different widths to look at to make sure the flux quantum was right. Now, this is the first day that we tried to make lead-lead junctions. And I think it's interesting because it shows the way that my mind works. You have this strange characteristic here, which probably John Waldron and John Atkins would recognize because they studied things like this, where you get this extra current below the gap. If this junction, this lead-lead junction was ideal, should be very small current here, and then a nice sudden jump, and we got this instead. And I said this, noted that the structure is apparently at subharmonics of the gap. But then I measured, at the bottom of the same page, I measured the current versus field. I had a coil in the viewer by then, so I could apply a field which I knew the magnitude of, and I just sketched this Fraunhofer pattern, not a particularly good one because of the leakage in the junction. But what interests me is that there's no note here that this should be a Fraunhofer pattern, which means by then we had accepted it, but I don't know where it came from. There's no entry in my notebooks saying, you know, Phil or Brian today said the field dependence should be this. So I think it's in correspondence between the two of you, actually.
Is it something in the original paper, or about it being like interference?
I thought you just said it would be sensitive. Oh. Anyway, but obviously by this time, which is May of 63, the Fraunhofer pattern was how it should be, and it was accepted as that. But then, you see, this is how easily distracted I am. At the bottom here, I was much more interested that day in taking a derivative. If I could take a derivative with this equipment I had, then I was much happier. So this is a derivative within the gap. That's the gap rise. And you get all this subharmonic structure, which long afterwards was explained in terms of Andreyev reflection in a little fault in the junction. So this is the next day, I think. We made another lead-lead junction. Good Josephson currents go up to half of the 2 delta currents, so they were quite large. And the critical current reduced with the field, getting very tiny values at the minima. And that's what we published. This is actually the original data that I plotted on a log scale, critical current versus field. And I put it on a log scale because I was... Well, you had to, because in the minima, the current was so small, like down here, compared to the central maximum, and then the minimum here couldn't be measured. Right? Yeah. But that was sent to the drafting department of Bell Labs and dressed up, and that was the figure that was published. Now the AC effect was seen a little later by Sid Shapiro, and actually Ivor Gaber submitted a very similar paper the day afterwards. But that confirmed the AC effect, which you'll hear about in later talks, is now used as the standard volt. And as you will also hear later, the group at Ford made this double junction interference experiment. Now, this is when Phil, in 1964, early 64, when Phil kind of generalized the Josephson effect. Phil suggests that the structures of Parkes and, Parkes and Moschel, narrow superconducting constrictions should, in low field, the weak coupling regions between bulk superconductors so should exhibit Josephson effects. In fact, he considers Parkes' results are Josephson measurements. And that's at the top of this page, and by the bottom of the page, he suggested to Ali Dayem, who was also at Bell Labs, well, Ali made this little constriction, which sometimes now is known as the Dayem Bridge, and when he put microwaves on that, gets these wonderful, this pattern for the microwave response is actually much clearer and more detailed than anything that's been made in a cross junction. The Dayem bridge is almost ideal for coupling in the radiation. So you can see all the all these main peaks, like one is here, and two is here, and all the different subharmonic features. Now, it was mentioned, Phil mentioned in his talk that he thought we had a patent or a patent, and well, we did try, succeeded eventually. But this is in, sorry, just mind if you keep doing that. Yeah. In July, I went to the patent department and suggested use of Josephson oscillation. For the interesting sentence is this one here. No interest from Torsiglieri, who was the head patent lawyer. So he just told us to go away. But later, when we decided to publish the lead paper, he finally agreed that something should be written up. So these were the ideas that were copied and sent to him, and then we wrote more, and the patent was written, and as far as I know, it's the first patent on the Josephson effect. Another final thing about Phil's contribution. At one time, before silicon memory became so powerful, there was a big program actually at Bell Labs on magnetic bubbles as memory elements. And a few of us, including Phil, were talking that you might be able to use fluxoids in a thin film, a continuous thin film, as a memory element also. But it says here, Phil and Ted Fulton believe the structures that I drew earlier are slow, too slow to be of interest, to be essentially creating normal material in the superconductor, in the core of the fluxoid, and you're trying to move fluxoids around. Phil suggests as an alternative a Josephson structure depicted in the opposite page, which is a copy of something he drew up in his notebook and sent to me, and I'm sorry the quality is poor, but this is what his idea was, that you would have a single Josephson fluxoid trapped in these, this is looking down on a junction which is patterned to this shape, and the fluxoids would be localized in these places. And you'd be able to move them around, and you could trap them here, and you could sense them here, reading loop, IC depends on birth cortex or not. But I think the really interesting part of this page, I mean, this was, as far as I know, the first proposal to use single flux elements as something in a computer or memory element, long before single flux quantum logic. But this is the interesting part. This is the way that Phil would encourage us to work. He said, You see, read over here. Peter Wolfe. Now, Peter Wolfe was a kind of competing director, so it's a different chain of command. Peter Wolfe says, Ali Dayan will do this if none of you guys will. So we did have to do it. Now this is my final notebook page, which I didn't know I had till I was looking through them recently. Read at the top here. Today we'll try and make a galvanometer of the type described by Clark, preprint from Cambridge. And we tried to do a better job than John had done, of course. Anodized the wire. We were going to punch two little holes in it with a spark discharge through the anodized layer to make two controlled point contact junctions. So that's an introduction to what you're going to hear in the next talk. So in summary, Brand's effects were predicted in his physics letter submitted in June 8, 1962, and were observed within 12 months. The DC effect in January 63 at Bell Labs, as I've described, the AC effect June 63 at A.B. Little by Sid Shapiro and some collaborators. And then applications that you'll be hearing about in the rest of the day have followed over the past 50 years. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have time for questions.
When Phil Anderson talked about it over lunch once, he said that in his mind, in connection with the patent and so on, right from the beginning also was the idea of making a register, which was interesting to telephone companies.
Mm-hmm.
One could use the series of process injunctions as a register.
Like a shift register. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That was in his mm-hmm. mind right from the beginning.
I see. Mm-hmm.
Was that in your... Was that part of the conversations you told or what?
I don't remember that specifically until this. We had this discussion about the magnetic bubble equivalent.
Any questions? Okay. If not, let's thank John again.